Well, Maggie Payne is sitting in my kitchen, and we're drinking ice water and coffee and things. Well, she's not drinking coffee, of course, Puritan that she is in certain aspects. I would never deign to say that you're Puritan in every aspect. I've learned, far be it from me. I've jotted down a lot of questions that I want to ask you, and I'm just going to fire away, I suppose, and I don't know what, they're not in any sort of order. But when you're composing a piece, do you think beforehand of what you're going to do? Do you map it out, so to speak, or is it pretty instinctual, or what?
I have actually several ways of working on it, on pieces, but mostly since I, I really do deal with sound and this character of the sound. I'm of utmost importance to me is timbre.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really interested in the texture and the timbre. So what I typically will do will be, if I'm working on a sampler, I'll work and work and work and work on developing a voice that I think is very interesting. I'll sample and resample and then data compress and add more data and just change the mix and change the filtering and change everything and then resample and go back and forth until I get something that I'm fairly interested in. And I just get all this sound information together and I finally start the idea of actually composing something with it. I need all the basic sound materials before I can start trying out what's going to fit with what will make a good transition into what else, what that structure is going to be and where the dynamics of the structure are going to be, because mm-hmm. I don't know if you noticed, but I'm also really interested in a dynamic build-up.
Yes.
Where things start going very soft.
It's extraordinarily dramatic.
Yeah, and crunch out there. But, you know, part of that is getting these timbres that will add in together without destroying each other.
What typically would be about the most voices that you would tend to use?
I think 48 voices at once is the most. Well, that's not, I mean, I should say 48 tracks because I can play up to 8 notes for those voices, so whatever 48 times 8 comes out to be would be the densest structure. And there are sections where it's extraordinarily dense, and other sections where it's just paper thin, very thin wire. Yeah,
yeah, it's the build up is very emotional and lush usually. What else was I going to ask you about that? Do you use a lot of acoustic sources?
I didn't.
I know you use flute.
Yeah, but aside from the two flute pieces for the major works, Hum and Sirocco were flute pieces done 10 years apart from each other. I figure every 10 years, why not? Yeah. But until I got a sampler, I didn't really use much concrete or found sound.
So you use synthesizer.
Yeah, until I did, actually one piece before that I did called White Knight.
Oh,
which
yeah.
Which is all the names of people, right, that we know and love. You're on there, Barb. Anyway, but White Knight used voice, it was my voice throughout, okay, saying different people's names.
Which is almost indiscernible that it's voice, by the way.
Of course, anyway. But since I have a sampler now, Airwaves is all sampled broadcast medium. It's all off the radio.
Oh, really?
I mean, Mick Jagger's in there. He'd never know it. You know, same thing. You know,
he'd never know it either.
No, there's no way, because by the time Mick Jagger's added to the Pointer Sisters is added to, it all gets added together and resampled. So there's no way to know.
What sort of sampler is it?
Oh, it's a Marantz.
When did you get it? I'm very jealous of all our equipment. Not that I'd know what to do with it, I don't even have a mixer.
No, but I'm looking desperately for a replacement. You know, the quality has certainly come up along quite a bit from the 8-bit sampler. So I got it about a year ago, I guess, 2 years, a year and a half. I guess a year and a half.
One thing that's startling in its starkness and beauty are your videotapes and your slides, but especially your recent videotapes. And I understand that you take these solitary trips out to either the desert or the mountains. Tell me about some of those trips. How do you set out on them?
Yes. my favorite.
How much time do you allot, and what do you take with you? And
well, listen, the last one I did was called Airwaves.
Which we are going to hear.
Yeah, and again, that's the one where you use sample sounds off broadcast television and stuff. And it has to do with unreality, and I figure television and radio are pretty good sources. But yeah, that one was an abbreviated trip because it was in mid-January and in Nevada, and I got up at 5 o'clock in the morning to go out to Pyramid Lake, which is an exquisite area. It's an Indian lake, and it's just, it's so beautiful, but it was 10 degrees with about a 40-mile-per-hour wind, and I had to shield, I had to use the car to shield the camera because it kept trying to blow off this heavy Miller tripod, you know. I was, so that was fun. I was freezing. But I got the shot that I wanted with the steam coming up off the lake. It was pretty insane.
Do you use the sound?
No. I never use, even the airplanes going over, those
amazing.
Those aren't the planes that were going over at the time. That's from another, totally, totally abstracted, totally different, yeah. Actually, you're right. I did use actual real sounds that I went out and recorded in those two. And the very beginning of Airwaves has real cars passing by Interstate 5. And those are real airplanes.
So how long do you go for, typically? Let's say, you said that was abbreviated.
Yeah, that was only a couple of days because there was a huge storm coming and I had to drive back.
And what do you do? Stay at a motel?
If it's summertime, no. Or, you know,
take a tent?
It's not. I went snow camping once, and it's something I'm not fond of.
No, I wouldn't. No,
but yeah, I'll stay in the cheapest, sleaziest hotel I can find. If I have to. Yeah. I love tooling out in the desert. It's just, it's so beautiful.
I haven't done it yet. I mean, by myself, you know? And I'm quite solitary as a rule in my daily or habitual kind of things, but I still haven't done a lot of driving around by myself, although I travel abroad by myself. Yeah. That's kind of fun.
Somehow being in the desert by yourself with your car full of water.
Yeah.
It really puts you at, I don't know what to say. There's a lot of danger involved. Not a lot, I mean, but there's a degree because you can be there for hours and hours and not see any human and not see any sign of a human. So I try to stay within, like, I figure I can walk 20 miles, you know, without, like, keeling over too badly. So I try not to go by myself more than about 20 miles away.
God, I'm impressed.
Bitten by something horrible.
I'm a wimp.
No,
total wimp. That way.
Try it sometime. I like it.
Maybe. So what's the very first music you remember listening to as a child, your earliest memory?
Gosh. I don't know. I don't remember a piece or anything. I think what I do remember is that my parents trying to make me take piano when I was like 4 or 5.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of did a little and went, wasn't terribly fond of the idea, but when I was age 9, we went somewhere and I heard a flute and I said, yeah, that's it. And they were kind enough to go rent one for a while and then buy one after a while. It was the sound, you know, it was
the timbre. There again,
I mean,
it was
pianos,
the timbre.
Yeah, pianos are wonderful and all that, but it wasn't the sound that I wanted. And then I heard.
Yeah, that's kind of obvious from your work that
it's,
you know,
something in it. Yeah.
That the flute is the tones, the long long tones, and that type of timbre.
Yeah.
What was that story that you tell? That's a fabulous anecdote that you were in university or something, and you were just practicing flute.
Oh, you mean the bird story? No, which story is this?
The story that someone heard you practicing flute and just kind of signed you up on the spot for something. You either got a scholarship somewhere or you got, I don't know what it was, but it was a wonderful apocryphal Maggie Payne story.
That was very sweet. Actually, the story I like better. That was.
But what is that story? And then tell us the story you like better.
Okay. Well, no. That's, I mean, this is kind of embarrassing. But that was just...
You don't have to say names.
No. I think you're talking about the time I went to Yale and I auditioned there to go to school, and then on the way back we stopped at a couple of college. I needed to practice, you know, I was real serious about it, and I, you know, couldn't go a day without practicing, right? Mm-hmm. So we stopped somewhere, and my friend at the time was trying to get teaching jobs. He was a professor and all that, so I was just practicing away, and yeah, they did. It was real sweet. Some guy came in and just offered me a full scholarship and all that, which is kind of sweet, you know. That's really nice, because flute players, as they say, are a dime a dozen.
Well, you're a hot one.
I don't know.
And what's the bird story?
Oh, the bird story. Do you know, well, of course you know, Messiaen, but he wrote this flute piece called Le Mer Noir, The Black Bird.
Yes, I have it,
and
a record of it.
Yeah, it's a wonderful piece. So mm-hmm. I was practicing at Northwestern in this place called The Beehive, which is, I mean, just... awful, but I mean, just a series of little practice rooms. It was summertime, so the window was open, and I kept playing. I was practicing the piece over and over, and I started up again, started playing it, and this cat flew through the window. You know, just jumped through the window.
Oh, that's cute. I never heard that.
Yeah, I tossed the cat out. I mean, I walked around and put the cat outside.
I love it.
It happened 4 times.
I love it. That's the greatest.
So Messiaen should be very proud of himself, I think.
Oh, you should have written him a letter.
I should have. I was too shy. Just too shy.
The pause button's up, isn't it? I just had a momentary panic. Okay.
No, we're actually...
I mean, we're fine.
I'm
good.
Actually a recording engineer.
Oh, good. I know. But I thought, you know, that's just trust a recording engineer to sort of screw up.
Yeah. Well, we always catch ourselves.
When was your first electronic experience?
Music.
Yeah, music-wise. Like, when did you first...
My first electronic experience with my brother building oscilloscopes and Jacob's Ladders. But my first...
Oh.
Electronic?
Were you little and he was doing that stuff?
Oh, yeah. He was 9 and he built his first oscilloscope. And I was very jealous because my parents said...
You're a girl.
They said, you're a girl. You can't do... both his chemistry set and his electronics, they said, you can't do that. You'll hurt yourself. And then some doctor or lawyer won't want to marry you.
Yeah, there's a good Pauline Alvaro story like that.
It's totally disgusting in a lot of ways. Yeah. However, I mean, in a lot of ways. But coming from Texas... during that time, I mean,
that's where she's from. Her story is that in kindergarten, she in the rhythm band or something, she wanted to play the drums, and they said, No, little girls can't play the drums, you know, you have to play the harp or something. So then what happened? What was your very own?
My electronic stuff, it kind of catches into everything else in that when I went to Northwestern, I auditioned for, I can't remember, a couple of touring orchestras and some symphony orchestras, and they all said, great, and they said, well, how old are you? And I said, I'm 19, and they said, oops, sorry, we can't take you after all, because you're underage. What does that mean? So I got kind of unhappy about that whole idea, you know, that you have to be a certain age.
Yeah, really.
So, I don't know, I got into the contemporary music, and I think a lot of what I was hearing was, we go down to the University of Chicago, Ralph Shapey concerts, not his music, but he was conducting at the time a lot, and there were, you know, they played a lot of electronic music, and I saw Varez there, one of his last actual personal appearances.
It's easy to start getting hooked.
Yeah. And the whole place was just electrified. It was wonderful. But after that, the experience I got was the first actual hands-on, true hands-on stuff was at University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana. They had it... a minimal Moog setup, but it was great, in a classical studio setup with James Beauchamp, and it was wonderful. It was sort of wonderful to have it classical, and which means not voltage control and stuff, you know, a lot of tape splicing and stuff. So it was wonderful, and it was a wonderful time to be at that school. Yeah.
So Who, you know, aside from Verez, who were your big influences early on in? In the very beginning, who just grabbed you? Yeah, right.
In terms of...
I still play some of the inventions every day on the piano, every morning.
Bach, it's just, I mean, every time I pick up the flute, that's what it is.
He's so modern. I mean, he really is timeless.
Well, he understood phrase like nobody understood phrase and breath. And if, I mean, I think that's a lot where I get that sense of phrase, although my phrases are rather extended. But anyway, Gordon Mumma was at the University of Illinois when I was there, and he had a lot of influence on an idea that I still hold very dear, and that's spatial location and modulation, having sound move in space. And he had a real strong influence on that. There are a lot of pieces that he was doing at the time that were just amazing, and some of his older work as well. He was still performing Hornpipe at the time, which is a wonderful piece, live electroacoustic piece, and his Dresden Interleaf, which is really electronic, but just incredible pieces.
Yeah,
he's
playing that on
ideas.
The radio.
Yeah, but his particular attention to the idea of spatial location and modulation stuff.
And when did you move on to Mills?
I came to Mills. Gordon was at the University of Illinois at the time, which was 1970, and he suggested that I call Bob Ashley, who was out here. And I did, and I said, can I come? And he said, okay. So I came. So it was 1970. I came out here.
And then would you say that you were influenced by Bob's work or by Bob as a person or
I'd say
composer?
Bob as a person and Bob as a professional. Our work is obviously totally different.
Yeah.
He's very much into word and word idea and wonderful thought processes.
It's just about poetry. It could be called poetry or prose or something, but
stories. Yeah, he's working on a different level altogether, but it was more his approach to the process of working, his attention to, extraordinary attention to detail, his total professionalism when he worked.
Yeah, and I think the dedication is conveyed, that was very well conveyed to his students. Wouldn't you say that you didn't necessarily have to be in the mode of or the same genre at all?
It was
the attitude. I think it's an attitude.
Well, he had you're right. I mean, a lot of his strength lay in his own attitude, but also his open attitude toward almost all kinds of works, and also his wonderful attitude towards his former students and peers, because he uses. I mean, it's really great because he uses a lot of his former students in his performances, and they have the privilege of performing with him and working with his work, and he has the privilege of getting this fresh, different vantage points from them as well. And of course, the long relationship of he and Blue Jean is just one of the, it's just amazing.
When I came to Mills, I had signed up for the composition department, and I strayed over into the Center for Contemporary Music and met, in one fell swoop, Maggie Payne, Blue Jean Tierney, and Robert Ashley, and I was dazzled and bewitched. And
we forced you to join this.
And I just have my life's never been the same. So. I understand whereof you speak very much so.
Yeah.
You said something that I was just going to ask you, because you don't use words. You seldom or never you use words, right?
I use...
Am I screaming?
No, you're fine. I'm just turning this down a little bit. I'm screaming too. I use words, but only for their sound. It's sort of, Charles Lamarckine sort of has that same sense, but he wants his words to be audible.
And I don't care.
I want the character of the voice. I want the character that, the voice over television is much different idea, a much different sound.
Sure is.
By far. And that's what I'm after. The timbre without the content, the content, hopefully, as it gets so permuted as I work with the sound so much, hopefully it's how it fits into the overall structure of the piece. Yeah.
You've been working with Ed Tannenbaum a lot, doing soundtracks for his videos. Has that been fun?
Oh, it's great. He's wonderful. He came to Mills, I can't remember exactly the date.
He was there when I got there, which was 79.
Yeah, he had been there, I think, a year prior to that. He's just this marvelous video artist who uses live dancers on stage with digital processing of those dancers that simultaneously gets projected on a screen, either above them or to one side of them. And it's just wonderful to watch the source, you know, the actual dancers and what they're doing, and then what the processing does with what they are doing. It's
so
just wonderful.
So do you see the videos first and then do the music?
There was only one case where I did the music to an already finished piece, and that was called, he calls it Viscous Meanderings, and I call it Flights of Fancy.
That's not too different.
Yes.
No,
but all the rest, we'll talk over some basic ideas, and I'll do the music, and usually he accepts it right off, and then he goes and does incredible images to it. He thinks of, I know people on the radio can't see, but the beginning of or he calls it Cue the Lizards.
Mm-hmm.
It's just all this watery stuff happening, and he has this this incredible body come out. And it's really quite nice. He comes up with wonderful ideas.
Who are your current favorite composers that you listen to now, or that you admire, that are writing now? Whether they're very unknown or not known or whatever.
That's rough, because there's so many. I mean that sounds a little odd, but no, I'd be afraid.
Does someone come to mind, or?
Oh, everybody. Paul DeMarinis, Paul Drescher, Leticia de Campin. I love your work. I love Charles McConaughey. I love Carl Stone. I mean, David Berman, very much.
Mm-hmm. I do too.
Of course, Bob Ashley. I mean, just John Adams, just incredible textures.
It's fun, isn't it? That there are so many people that
and
we enjoy.
So different. Uh-huh. They're so different. That's the important thing that we're
That's what gives it room for. That's what gives room for everyone. That there is diversity.
I think the West Coast is particularly fortunate in that we're free from the
European
academic.
Oh, good! I
academic.
Love to hear that.
Yeah, but
I
it's
love
true.
To hear that.
The mad dogs, you know. we're free of much of that Europeanism, or the East. You know, some of the East Coast is rather.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody comes out sounding like whoever's the main composer at that institution, and that's not. People should come out sounding like what they are, not what, you know, some mimicry or something. No.
Do you like other genres of music, like pop or country or?
I better work with it enough. Yeah.
You know, like what? What do you like to listen to?
I don't.
Or what do you admire? You know, not necessarily. Like, you don't have any time to listen to anything.
I don't have much time. Because I'm easily listen to NPR in the car. You know, like KPFA or something. I like most musics. I don't. Just, I mean, I love. I certainly. Did not like disco, and I didn't like what it did to the recording industry.
No, it was boring. It wasn't great. Yeah, it was boring music.
And there's an edge of that now where there's a lot that's fairly much the same.
Too produced.
Yeah, and just too much the same. Well, in country, you got that way too.
Yeah.
Yeah, so anyway, anything that tends to have a real character to it that hasn't gotten overdone, and there's a lot of it, you know, there's a lot.
What about world music? I mean, you know, typically non-Western, what would you
mostly
listen to?
I can only get that through the radio, and again, that's David Meyer on Wednesdays. I'm KPFA, what can I say?
Great.
I don't have a turntable.
Good KPFA.
I don't have a CD player, so I just, you know.
But you're making a CD,
yeah,
right?
Right, what? But I mean, I'm not, but I'm producing one, yeah.
Tell us who's on that with you.
Hard to make it.
What composers are... Yeah. Well, making was with quotations.
I'm just kidding. Let's see. It's Paul Drescher has two pieces on there, and Carl Stone has two pieces on there. Paul De Marinas, Leticia de Campion, and I have a piece on there.
And when will it be out? When will it be available? Do you know?
As soon as I can go over to Fantasy and get it transferred over to the Mitsubishi format.
What's the label?
Music and Arts Programs. It's a local label. It's sort of a small label, but he's trying. I think it might work.
Oh, it's wonderful.
Yeah.
Wonderful. What about future creative plans? Do you have any slated?
I guess if we can just keep going at all.
That's how I feel. But
keep pounding. I sort of have a discipline where I'm always trying to work on something. I mean, there's always something there. And there's one piece I'm not sure if it's going to come to fruition or not. It's called Rock and Roll.
Ooh.
Which is actually not rock and roll. Sorry.
Oh, I didn't think it was going to be literally rock and roll, but I love the title.
It would be sort of fun.
It certainly augurs some type of rhythm.
But it's mostly, I think, sampling, you know, when you go into fast forward or rewind on tape machines, that kind of dense kind of stuff. And I'm not sure it's going to work. I'll just have to see.
When do you compose? I mean, I remember typically that you, I've been using that word typically quite a bit. I love it today. Every Sunday for years.
Yes.
So now you have three jobs and social life of sorts.
No social life.
When do you really work on your music?
Yeah, well, there was 2.5 years where I was working 7 days a week, and that was really rough. And then I just go to work and work every evening. That's when White Night was done.
Uh-huh.
And just work. And a lot of the Shimmer and I think Back to Forth, those pieces were done.
Flux. Oh, I love Shimmer. Yeah. I love Crystal, too.
Yeah. But I work whenever I can, whenever I have enough of a block of time, a minimum, I need at least 3 hours to get anywhere.
Oh, I know.
You can't just like, oh, I'll just, no, you can't.
Yeah.
I can't even listen seriously for a real short time span.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it has to be serious. So whenever there's a serious day off, unless I'm just getting so desperate that I have to take a drive to the country, which is important for me, then I can try to work.
What advice do you have for young composers?
Oh,
or new composers?
Just keep at it. I don't know. That one's a tough one.
What's the minimal equipment? If someone was starting a studio, what's the minimal equipment they should get?
That's hard because everybody works so differently. Some people can be Barbara, footloose and fancy free pretty much. Cause
I have my piano.
Yeah, right. I mean,
and music paper.
And your voice.
But it's not enough.
Yeah.
Believe me, it's not enough.
Yeah. Like, it's really hard to say. Some people do absolute miracles with these little Porta studios and stuff. You know, four tracks, and it comes out.
The four-track cassette decks?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's where I'm going to go. I think I'm going to have to do that, get into that, and use it as a mixer and use it as everything.
Yeah, and if you're doing electronic stuff, and if you don't mind the idea of, excuse me, MIDI, then you can have a sync track on their drive, a whole bunch of different MIDI
mm-hmm.
equipment. On the other hand, if you have a substantial multitrack, then you don't have, I mean, that, you know, if you're driving all this MIDI at once, that means you got to have all that equipment.
Right.
So it means a lot of different synthesizers and stuff. If you have, I have very limited equipment.
What do you have?
I have a lot of multitracking capability, but very little equipment like the DX7 and the Mirage, you know, essentially. And so I can just combine that and keep combining it.
So you have the DX and the Mirage, and then what's your track capability? I mean, you have a 16-track tape deck?
Uh-huh.
Great.
Well, you know, the textures, that's essential.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, that's why I worked 2.5 years, uh-huh. 7 days
uh-huh.
a week, so I could do that.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I think it's hot.
I wish it worked better. No.
Oh. Okay, you have a whole day of leisure. What do you do with it?
The last day of leisure I had, I worked out my income taxes. That's a 40-hour. It takes
okay.
40 hours minimum.
And then your income tax is done, and then what?
Yeah. Three jobs make it complicated, yeah.
Yeah, I know.
There are times when I just have to get away from everything, and that means to the desert
mm-hmm.
or somewhere to the country in a nice, long, and fast walk. I traipse uh-huh. out pretty rapidly when I go. If that's not possible, if it's raining like crazy, or if, you know, I just if I don't feel a need for it, then it's into the studio, you know.
Uh-huh.
I just live there. It's kind of nice.
Sounds very enviable. And you have a really good lifestyle as far as eating. What do you eat?
You do this to me.
What do you eat? What's your favorite? Like, if you're thinking, okay, you can really indulge. What's your favorite stuff, like indulgent stuff to eat for you, for anyone else? This would be like health food, but for Maggie, let's see, you're really indulging.
No. Okay, the most indulgent thing I do is, A, I'm not domestic, so I don't cook
uh-huh.
very well. Okay, I can survive on what I can, but it's Siam cuisine. I mean, what can I say?
Oh, I love that,
yeah,
too.
I have to
say that I'm getting closer and closer to you that way. I buy bread and cheese and beer,
yeah.
And I'm happy as a clam. But it's got to be very good cheese, very good bread, and very good beer.
Yeah. Well, actually,
you don't drink beer.
No, and I try not to eat much cheese, but it's tofu.
Mm-hmm.
Tofu and some rice or something, and veggies. When I cook, I hate to cook.
Yeah, I only like to cook now on very special occasions.
Yeah, it's just I don't have time. And when I come home, I just as soon have yogurt and some mm-hmm. fruit and
mm-hmm.
go back into the studio, or mm-hmm. salad and go back into the studio, you know.
So what are you going to do tonight when you go home?
I'm going to go into the studio.
Do you just put your feet up for a while, or do you go straight into the studio?
I usually have, you know, a little yogurt or something, a little dinner. And then go in, pay whatever bills have to be paid, and all that some fun stuff.
Are you happy?
Am I happy? Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know.
I think so. No, I think so.
I think that has to just do with your overall general outlook rather than a day-to-day
idea. Yeah, I think so, too. And it's a... You